And you make 100% of your income from your online endeavors, or are you able to totally support your family's websites?
All my income is made through my hard-to-find seminars business and my pen manufacturing business, my hard-to-find ads website, my Monaco products website, which is all my different pens. That's correct. My pen business and my hard-to-find seminars business is all the money that comes in, and that supports my business, my family. I don't do anything else. I don't have any other kind of job except the stuff I'm doing online.
Which one of those two, between your pen and the hard-to-find seminars, which one of those two is the biggest producer?
The biggest producer? Pen business has been the biggest producer, because I've sold probably close to now 750,000 pens since I started. Pen business is great. To make a product for 17 cents and to be able to wholesale them by the hundreds for $1.50 or $1.25 is great. When I figured out how to manufacture a pen in the back of my house without any equipment, I mean, that was just incredible, because these things take up very little room. I'll give you an example. I just had a pen order from a company called Cardinal Brands. Cardinal Brands is in all the Office Maxes. They have a little display in the Office Max doors where you've heard of scrapbooking, where women take photos of their kids.
Big stuff you say.
It's a huge thing. It's called the scrapbooking industry. Now, I was selling my Red Eye pens and my pH testing pens and my vanishing ink pens to the scrapbooking industry, to retail stores. They buy them from me wholesale in boxes of 100 for $150 a box. My cost was about $17 for 100. So I could easily clear net $100 every time I sold a box. But then I got a call from Cardinal Brands. They found me on the internet. They were looking for a Red Eye pen that they can put in these little displays. And they placed an initial order for, it was 6,000 Red Eye pens.
Wow.
And 6,000 Red Eye pens, I gave them a price of 67 cents. I know what my cost is. I'm going to make 50 cents on each one. We made them up in 3 days. I've got a nanny here who takes care of my 14-month-old. And when the kid's napping, she's making pens. I actually had her come in two Saturdays in a row, and we finished up the pens. And it's $3,000. But what did I have to do? Nothing. It's all set up. I got all the pen parts here. She makes them. I put them in bags of 100, and off they go.
You're actually producing this pen product right in your house.
Right in the back of my house, and I've got a whole virtual tour of the back of my house and exactly how we manufacture the pens right at my website at idpen.com. When I was really hustling the Red Eye pens a couple years back, I couldn't handle the manufacturing, and I farmed it out. I found a pen manufacturer to do all the fulfillment and all the imprinting on the pens, and I'd order them from him like 30, 40,000 at a time.
Still doing that on that?
No, I'm not. My cost to imprint the pen was 7 cents, and it was a hassle because I had to put upfront money just for an imprint on the pen. And if you screw up that imprint, you're stuck with the pens, you see? For my Red Eye pens, I don't even offer an imprint on the pen. It's just I buy the pen parts from my pen supplier blank. They're just black pens, and I put a different color plug on the end, which tells me what pen it is, and the display sells what the pen does, and no one really cares that there's an imprint on the pen. What they care about is what the pen will do for them.
And so you're not having to, like, add ink to anything, or anything? I mean, these are things that you're just pretty much assembling some parts that are mostly already put together?
All the parts are assembled by my nanny. They're pre-assembled. I mean, there is a process to do it, which is something that I finally figured out on my own. If you went and tried to do this on your own, you'd have a huge learning curve.
Yeah.
So there's little things that I've learned. With my pen business, I sell a pen licensing opportunity where I'll teach people how to do exactly what I've been doing. Once you know how to make a pen, you can put any kind of juice in it, any kind of liquid in it that solves a problem, and you have a product.
So you're actually adding this chemical or whatever to, like, some sort of little soaker upper in
there? That's correct. There's a little filter inside the pen. It's called almost like a little magic marker. Haven't you ever taken them when you were a kid, you take the magic marker apart,
yeah,
and you see that little filter? It looks like a little tampon.
Yeah, or like a cigarette butt.
That's correct. A certain material that holds the ink, and there's different materials. You need different materials for different inks. It depends on what kind of ink. There's some chemistry involved, which I have expert access to with one of the largest ink manufacturers. You just buy everything separate. I buy my ink separate. I buy the tips that go in the pen separate. I buy the plastic pen parts separate. You know, I have my displays, which I have made. It's a real easy process once I figured it out. I was talking to my wife about this. We were laughing because when I first started in the early days, days. Imagine these filters, and we're making thousands of pens. And I didn't know how the heck do I get the ink inside this filter. I couldn't figure it out. We thought, well, maybe we had to take syringes and squirt it in. And for years, and this is a true story, for years, I had the girls making my pens. They would put two of the little filters, like they're putting two cigarettes in their mouth. They would bend their head down into the pot of where the ink was and have to suck it in there like a straw. And we'd do them two by two.
Did you ever get, like, ink in your mouth or anything?
No, you never got ink in your mouth. But, you know, what we were doing wasn't the most safe thing.
No,
and it was just only until I figured out that that never needed to be done. All I needed to do was take these and soak them, and they would absorb. They would self-absorb, and I could do them 300-400 at a time.
Wow.
And because I never even thought about it or really gave much thought to it, you know, thinking is so rarely done, but finally I did some thinking to figure out a better way how to do this, and that really solved a lot of problems for me, to be able to get the ink inside there without this laborious process. But that's how I started doing the ink.
Wow, that is interesting. When did you first get your first internet connection?
I'll tell you, I was one of the very first people to have high-speed cable internet connection through Roadrunner. I was single, living in Pacific Beach in San Diego, California, and Roadrunner was being tested in only two areas in the United States. One was San Diego, Pacific Beach, and one was somewhere in New York. I think I had an AOL dial-up connection back in 1995. I had the high-speed access almost just a year after that, and I've had it ever since.
So 95 was the first year you actually got on the Internet?
I think so.
So were you doing, like, before you ever got on the Internet, were you still doing your pen manufacturing?
I was just doing my pen manufacturing business then.
So that, like, or what were you doing before that?
Before that, and that's all in my bio, after I graduated from the University of Alabama, I had met a buddy out there, and we both wanted to come out to California, and we came out to California and got involved, and we were doing multi-level marketing. I was just searching for something. When I was at the University of Alabama, I had started a business where I started manufacturing tie-dye t-shirts. Well, I opened up a location. It was a retail store. It was called Tiki Tie-Dye, and I was making and selling tie-dye t-shirts. I started selling them at the Student Union building.
You actually owned a retail outlet?
I had a retail outlet. I lived in the back of my store, and I had this tie-dye business, and I was selling manufacturing tie-dye t-shirts. I had 7 employees, college kids. I had a secretary. I, you know, had a rent. I had inventory. I was selling to some of the large department stores in the South. Department stores, once they see that something's successful, they all jump on the bandwagon because they're all connected with each other. With department stores, you got to finance everything. You got to borrow money from the bank. It was all the traditional things that brick-and-mortar business goes through, and I saw all those negatives. I mean, I worked my butt off. I made some okay money, but it was very labor-intensive. The labor was killing me, and I did pretty good, but I didn't want those negatives. There had to be a better way to make money than all these hassles of running a business, managing employees, dealing with accountants, dealing with borrowing money, financing, all that stuff, all the overhead, the rent. And I wanted a better way, and that's when I started searching for something better. I got out of the University of Alabama. I closed my store. I brought all my inventory with me to Nashville. My brother was living in Nashville, Tennessee, so I went up there and lived with him for a year. I didn't even know I was going to California at that time. And while I was hanging out there, I was pretty flush with cash from the tie-dye business, and I was selling off my remaining inventory, and I was just kind of searching for something better. And then I came out to California with a buddy of mine, and I was still searching, looking into multi-level marketing, different kind of the get-rich-quick stuff that you probably experienced when you first came on the Internet.
Yep.
Looking for the easy way. You know, I hadn't found my passion or my niche, but I kept trying, and it was all a great learning experience. You know, the training I got from being involved in multi-level marketing was invaluable. There was some great training.
I look back at some of the stuff I did in the old days, and I know I was just actually listening to a Dan Kennedy tape recently where he said, you'll find that almost every great marketer will tell you that they did some heavy-duty selling, like, in the ditches, the trenches. They did some sort of, like, selling vacuum door-to-door or some selling pots and pans door-to-door or something that was really kind of grueling.
That's right. Well, I did. You know, I mean, I can remember as a kid, I would hustle greeting cards door-to-door in my neighborhood. When I was at Alabama in the evenings during the summer, I would go out and paint address numbers on curbs.
I did that, too.
Did you do that?
Gosh, I actually, my brother, I still remember the name. I called my business. I was probably like 17. I named my business Cytex. I just thought that sounded cool. I heard cyber at one point. The internet was getting going. And I called this little business Cytex, and I went down. I bought some stencils at the hardware store, and I did it. And I just went and I stuck little flyers on everyone's door, right on the doorknob, where I figured they couldn't miss it. And it just said, Cytex is coming through next week into your neighborhood, and everyone's getting their curbs painted. And it was kind of like this whole bandwagon thing. So you better not miss out, or you're going to look like the neighbor with the ugly curb. Oh, my God. That was actually a lucrative little business.
Absolutely. Now, I wasn't as sophisticated then. I didn't know anything about direct marketing. You were able to leverage it by using a flyer, an advertisement to sell the service. I was just knocking on the doors, and when someone answered, I would say, hey, my name is Michael Sunoff. I'm with Safety First. I'm in the neighborhood, and we're doing the address numbers on the curbs in case of any kind of emergency where you need ambulance, fire, police. We paint a 4-inch letter. You know, you just give them the spiel.
Yeah, well, you probably got a better return as far as how many contacts because you had that personal touch going, too. So.
Yeah, that's probably true. I remember a lesson in pricing. You know, I'm like, well, how much should I sell this for? And I started out doing it maybe $3, and then I go, well, let me try $5. And I did $5, then $7, and then $10, and then I would just feel it out. And if someone displayed a level of interest, I'd charge them $20.
My average is about $15 on curb painting.
And you can negotiate. And then I went on to do peepholes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the peepholes where you...
I'm more involved. I get the drill out for that.
Oh, yeah, no, I've got a whole story about my blue Makita drill. I bought a blue Makita drill, and you buy the peepholes at Home Depot for a couple bucks a piece. You go to find the neighborhoods with new houses or new homes being built where there are no windows on the side, and they have wooden doors with no way to view who's outside the door. And you knock on the door and you say, I'm doing the peepholes in the neighborhood. And they say, okay, how much? $20. You drill the hole, you screw the peephole in, and you're done.
You do it right on the spot?
Right on the spot. You got your drill in your hand.
Well, that's pretty cool. You just show them that, hey, you want to see a peephole in there in a minute?
You're here right now, and you show them. And that was all just direct sales. And I remember when I was staying with my brother up in Nashville, he would go to work. He was working with a company called Annexter, and he would go work an 8-hour, 9-hour, 10-hour day, then come home and maybe make $150. And then when he came home, I'd borrow his car, go into the neighborhood before it got dark, and I'd be out an hour and a half and come back with the same amount of money.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, well, these things you do when you're younger, I mean, they really do build character, and they set the foundation. And I realize, you know, they're not stupid or trivial. They're part of almost every, like, great, successful marketer.
I mean, back then, I wanted to learn how to sell, and that's what I was studying with Zig Ziglar, Brian Tracy. I thought learning how to sell was it, and that is important. And, you know, Zig Ziglar stuff, you learn secrets of closing the sale, and you learn all these closing techniques and things like that you have to memorize. And some of that stuff, I mean, it was great learning, and some of that stuff is great. But then when I got turned on to marketing, I realized marketing was really the leverage that takes your selling ability and multiplies it, and that's when everything changed.
Yeah, you just reminded me of something. The old days, I went to work for this little window shop that they sell dual pane windows, you know?
Right.
And you should want to see our hustler. This guy was so funny. Guy had this big long ponytail. He's the owner, but no one ever sees him. He just sends out his little troops. He directed us to do things that were so, I don't know, I'd say immoral.
Right.
But he would tell you, when you get appointments. He had his telemarketing crew get setting up appointments. They would tell you basically that the houses you're going to, you get a list of houses to go to. And I never even did it. I backed out when I heard their marketing techniques, but it would just always crack me up to think of, and I just thought about it, how he was saying, what you need to do, and this is, I wish I would have recorded it so people could hear what he was teaching. So he was saying, what you got to do, when you're in the house, first of all, he had specific rules that were so funny. You say, you gotta find out where the man of the house sits. You gotta know which chairs you're trying to identify, which one it's gonna look like. Now you gotta make sure you sit in that, because if he gets in the man of the house chair, he's gonna be in the driver's seat, and he's gonna. So the first thing you do, you sit in his chair. and that way you're in control. He's going to feel a little bit awkward. Everyone in the family, in the household, is going to recognize you're in the king's chair, and you're in command.
That's right.
And we said, before you even sit down in that chair, he said, if the TV's on, and you know, even if someone's watching, he said, I know it may sound a little rough, but just go ahead and go up and say, I'm just going to turn this TV off because so we can, you know, focus and get some business done here. No TV interruption. You just go ahead and turn it off. Take the captain's chair. He talks about, ends up saying how, make sure you get a drink for him. Get him, you know, welcoming in. And then tell him your head really hurt. Oh, I've got this horrible, horrible headache going on. And, oh, I feel like I'm going to throw up. It's so horrible. So they'll start offering you stuff, but maybe even if they don't, say, can I get, like, an aspirin or something to get me through this? And so they're going to be feeling sorry for you. They're going to be feeling like they know you and all this stuff. And it was so funny. And he would, I mean, these are the kind of tactics this guy used to run his company with.
This guy knew what works. He had a set of rules that were selling those dual-pane windows was successful.
Oh, and he got so serious about it that if you couldn't close, because you were like, you know, you're more or less just a little soldier ant, and you're in there, and he knows you're not, you know, not a marketing genius yet, necessarily, and he'd say, do not leave the house until you got the order. He'd say, if they're saying they need to think about it, they're not sure, he'd say, can I use your phone real quick? And they're always going to say, yeah. And you call, and you start sweating on the phone, and you start in the background, you're going, oh, you know, okay, I'm sorry, you know, I know, anything. You start stuttering, stumbling, and making up excuses, looking like you're sweating, and then, you know, you tell the people, like, my boss, I'm going to get, like, fired or, you know, whatever, I'm kind of in heat here, and he needs to maybe talk to you, if you could. Can you just talk to him for a second? And he says he'll get him on the phone, then he does the closing from there. I mean, this is how...
That's how it's done. And there's some great illustrations about selling. There's two movies. One is called Ten Men.
You ever... Oh, yeah.
Ten Men with Danny DeVito.
Uh-huh.
And then the other one is called Glengarry Glen Ross. Glengarry Glen Ross is about a group of salesmen who were selling kind of like timeshares. It's just, it's really, really good. But yeah, absolutely. You know, even Claude Hopkins, the greatest copywriter of all times, he would knock on doors and do direct selling. David Ogilvy was in direct sales. Gary Halbert sold encyclopedias. I'm sure Jay Abraham knocked on a lot of doors.
Common denominator these guys seem to have in common.
Absolutely. Ross Perot sold newspapers. Yeah, it is a common denominator. That initial direct sales experience is invaluable. And
what did you say was the first moment in life where you realized that you wanted to be an entrepreneur?
I don't know. I think even when I was a kid, I used to sell cinnamon toothpicks and selling bubble gum. Maybe that was in fifth and sixth grade. So I sold Cutco cutlery, which was a great experience. That was my first year out of college. And I came back to Atlanta, and I worked for a company called Outcast Corporation. And they were a direct marketing company selling cutlery. And it was called Cutco. It's the greatest cutlery in the world. It took me like 15 or 16 years to really realize how great this stuff is, and I finally have an entire set of it.
I just got nailed by a door-to-door salesman. Yes, this guy came to my door. My first reaction is, I look at him, and I just see he had a squirt bottle in one hand, a towel in the other, and I was starting to smell salesman real quick, and I was busy, and I'm about to, like, just, I'm trying to get rid of him. And he's good. I mean, I actually got his name and phone number and told him, I'm going to take you out of the cleaning world because you're good. Because after I heard his little pitch, this is phenomenal. But then it turned a little bit ugly. This guy, he's going around with this bottle spraying and cleaning all these little things. I'm telling him, like, I don't think so. He said, watch this. And he's spraying little parts of the window in front of us, little parts of aluminum trim down below on the doorstep, and he ran over, my car was real nearby, he started cleaning on a rim right there, and he just was like, watch this stuff work.
That's great.
Anything like that, I'm sitting there watching this guy, and he went from, you know, like enemy one minute, where I'm like, get off of my porch, you're annoying me, to where I'm sitting here watching this stuff clean, and I'm looking at this, I mean, it's like magic, I'm telling you, he took rust corroded stuff, and it just turned spotless, sparkling, shiny, and I couldn't believe this, and I'm actually, it's not just his selling, it's watching the stuff do its thing. Well, you know, the big trick I later find out is, he puts a little bit of...
This is the end of part 2. Please go to part 3.
here's a tip. If you're listening to these audio recordings in MP3, here's a way where you can listen through the content twice as fast and still be able to absorb all the information. What you want to do is you want to go to a website and download a free trial of goldwave.com, GOLDWAVE.com. Now, this is an audio file editor, and one of the features on this editor is it allows you to play the audio recordings at any speed you want. So you can have it speed up to where it sounds like you're listening to the chipmunks where their voices are real high. But I do a lot of editing of audio recordings, and I find when I'm doing the editing, you're still able to listen to audio content about twice the speed of normal language. And it takes a little bit of practice, but you can fly through audio content. So if you like to learn by audio and you want to listen to content and you don't mind listening to the different higher pitch voice, it's a very effective way of getting through content twice as fast.